From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Dave Madden describes his interest in taxidermy not as participatory but spectatorial. That is to say, he's less interested in stuffing an animal himself as looking at the one that has been. Madden says he likes the stillness of it, likes touching it, and he appreciates the craft that goes into creating this illusion of life out of a dead carcass. Dave Madden has written a book about taxidermy, though it's not just a history and it's not just an examination of a subculture, though there are elements of that in the book. Really, it's about that impulse to stuff an animal, and people have been doing it for thousands of years. And why? Dave Madden will join us today to explain what he's learned. The Authentic Animal, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some people like seeing stuffed animals. That is the work of a taxidermist. Some not so much. The writer Dave Madden likes them for some reason. He likes the stillness, he says, of a good specimen. And he appreciates the craft that went into the illusion. Madden has written a book which is about taxidermy, though it's not just a history, and it's not really just an examination of this subculture. Here's what the book is about. Madden wants to answer this small but complicated question. Why do we stuff animals? Because people have been stuffing animals for thousands of years. The book is also about the need to collect animals, whether to preserve your pet, the mechanics of it all, and the ethics of murder and death. His book is called The Authentic Animal, Inside the Odd and Obsessive World of Taxidermy, and Dave Madden is joining us today to talk about it. Dave Madden teaches creative writing at the University of Alabama. The Authentic Animal is his first book, and he's joining us today from the studios of WUAL in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And Dave Madden, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, it's very great. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with people's impressions of taxidermy. What do you figure most people's impressions are? Because the thing that comes first to most of our minds, I have to say, and in the book you say, there's this kind of queasy, kitschy, fringe, weirdo element to it. So what's the first thing most of us think about?
Usually the first thing people think about is Norman Bates. I mean, he's sort of our famous, you know, like the history of taxidermy. He's our sort of number one celebrity. So I think that, you know, a lot of the ideas of taxidermy being this creepy thing is based on the fact that here's this man who not only mounted these birds and other animals, but his mother, you know, preserved, you know, it's that sort of level of weirdness. But, you know, there's something about the taking of an animal and leaving its remains around that, I mean, you know, for a lot of reasons. I think because we would never do this to human beings, doing it to animals is kind of, you know, weird and off-putting.
So what is the thing that led you first to taxidermy? I mean, you've talked about the fact that it wasn't necessarily taxidermy at first. You had this kind of thing for habitat dioramas. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I've always loved those. If I go to a natural history museum, that's my sort of first visit, my favorite stop. And so I just wanted to write about that at first, sort of looking at these dioramas as a kind of way that we make narratives about nature and animals, you know.
But wait, was your interest kind of ironic that they're kind of dorky and cheesy?
No. I mean, you know, of course, it's particularly the fact that like many of them were made so early in the 20th century and haven't been touched since. And so there is a dorkiness to them. Yeah. I will allow that. But
that wasn't your thing. You weren't interested
in that. No, I love them. Yeah. I liked the idea of that sort of, you could stand in front of that space, you know, and just sort of the intricacy of it. Some of them are just beautiful and the level of detail. And it wasn't until, you know, when I started looking into those and sort of researching the history of the diorama in the museum and kind of how they're made, it's only then that I discovered that the animals in those dioramas are taxidermized animals.
Right.
It was my understanding that they were artificial, like the rocks were and the leaves were. When you see sort of Aboriginal peoples in these dioramas, you don't assume they're real skinned, you know, like obviously. So when I realized that that's taxidermy, I thought, okay, well, what does that mean? What is the history of this? How does taxidermy work? And when I tried to do the research on it, I couldn't find much of anything. There were many, many how-to books on taxidermy. But very few at the time, very few histories of taxidermy or these kinds of general studies of what its significance might be in the culture. So I just had to do the research on my own, and before I knew it, I had a whole book on my hands. Hmm.
Do you think you, after writing the book and working through it, do you think you have a better answer to the question of, you know, why you seem to be kind of obsessed with it? I mean, you say in the book it's not a goth thing. You're not drawn to the morbid.
No.
So what do you figure it is? What is the thing that interested you about, you know, about taxidermy? Like at its core, what do you think it is?
For me, I think it's a way to engage in animals that's perhaps safe or, I don't know, one-sided. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk in the book about how I've never been an animal lover. I've had some pets growing up, but it's not a thing that I engaged in on a very active level. You know, I don't go out and hike and sort of see the wilderness or anything like that. And so for me, animals were always this other thing that sort of were over there, you know, and we humans were over here. And I early on, when I started really looking at taxidermy and trying to figure out what it meant and why people did it, I realized that it was a way to get access to animals or sort of encounter animals or engage in animals. The taxidermists that I met, it was very clear that they all loved the animals that they mounted, especially if they specialized in, say, white-tailed deer or something. There was this real sort of love and obsession there. Mm. And I thought, this is interesting. I don't understand this exactly, but I can see, in talking to these people, I can hear them connect this idea of loving animals to doing these things with their skin. So that was kind of where the book kind of really opened up for me, was this is not going to be a book about how taxidermists are just weird people that do this crazy thing.
Yeah.
But rather, here's a book about people that have this relationship to animals that is really complicated and really personal, and manifests itself in a way that's surprising and cool.
You know, what's interesting about the book is that it seems like much of it is about you kind of coming to terms with your conflicted feelings about all of it. I mean, your attitude changes throughout the book. I mean, it's first, you know, taxidermy is noble, and then taxidermy is fake, and then taxidermy is about love. I mean, you go back and forth, and you don't really resolve it, I have to say. At least it doesn't seem to me.
No, it's not resolvable, I don't think. I mean, it's the kind of the difficult thing about being this kind of nonfiction writer and having this approach to, you know, like wanting to write a whole book that tackles a single subject. The allure is, well, I'm going to write the sort of end-all, be-all book on taxidermy, or just somehow try to really take an encyclopedic approach. And it's just, I think what you saw in the book about how my attitude changes was just how gradually in the researching and writing of the book I realized that it just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
It's too big of a thing, and I'm only one person. And so there's a lot of that going on, but also there is, you know, just actual changes in my thoughts about taxidermy. Like I said, it began as like, wow, this is kind of a quirky subject for a book. And I knew that was only going to take me so far. So, you know, then it became this thing that I was really obsessed with and saw as a kind of form of beauty and a way that taxidermists and people can get close to animals. And then I saw the ethical questions behind it. I saw the sort of the history, and it's all of these things at once, and that's why I think it's worthy of reading about and thinking about for a while.
I think people might be surprised that you came to this obsession despite never having ever been a hunter. I mean, I guess most of us figure that they kind of go hand in hand, but do they?
They do in some level. I mean, you know, not every taxidermist is a hunter, but many of them are. And not every act of hunting ends in a form of taxidermy, but some of them do, the sort of trophy buck, if you will. Or, you know. So that was something that I had to figure out what to do with in the book. I save it for the very end. But throughout the book, you know, I just kept bumping into hunting and hunters and the culture of that, and then sort of throwing it all aside because I was like, no, this is a book on taxidermy, not hunting.
Right.
And, you know, eventually I was like, okay, Dave, stop, you know, deluding yourself. In some way I had to engage in that and ask questions about it and make the connection. And so I, you know, the final chapter looks at sort of big issues like death and human taxidermy. And so I was like, let's put it in here and sort of add it to that conversation.
Well, I want to have you read a section from the book, if you would, because you can't really get away from the fact that there is a connection, obviously, between taxidermy and death. As you put it, taxidermy needs animals to be dead. Taxidermy is death, as you say. There's a section here in the book that I wanted you to read, if you don't mind. Do you want to set this up or say anything about it?
Sure. Well, I mean, this part is from the introduction to the book, and you know, it's a really brief chapter. Most of the chapters are pretty lengthy, I guess, but this is where I tried to just sort of set up all of the sort of themes and discuss what this book was going to cover, and also, I guess, get into your other question, sort of why me? Why am I writing this book? Because people kept asking, "You don't do taxidermy. You're not a hunter." And it was a confusing question to answer. I didn't know myself, like, why are you writing this book, you know? Mm-hmm. And it took the writing of it for me to realize that it's just I couldn't stop thinking about it. And in fact, to come to the answers, I had to just sort of write my way through the book to just realize, you know, what taxidermy meant to the culture and what it meant to me. And so this introduction is kind of, you know, a kind of meditation on some of the issues that arise with this whole book, I guess.
Here it is, Dave Madden, an excerpt from The Authentic Animal.
Taxidermy is the neat red pinhole popped in the throat of a white-tailed deer one morning in November, the high five from father to son that sounds out in the quiet forest dawn. Taxidermy is a mountain lion crossing an interstate too far from home, smacked in the hip by a car's front bumper, and now rolling to the road's shoulder like some lost cargo left to bleed herself empty. Taxidermy is two ring-necked pheasants, one rooster and one hen, unmoving in a corn stubble field one North Dakota winter, watching and listening for another footfall of the man eyeing them along his sight. Taxidermy is the click of the trigger, the crack in the air, the explosion of feathers that go flying upward. Best to just admit it. Get it out in the open. Taxidermy is the American, the Englishman, the Frenchman, the Russian, the Western man of means in stately khakis, sturdy leather boots. It is the pack of paid-for kikuyus, the mother elephant sussed out of the jungle, the war story that gets told for generations, the trophy hung dramatically overhead. Taxidermy is the old brown owl found beak down on the floor of the barn one morning. It's the family dog that lived for 17 years now gutted, his fat stripped away from the flesh, his brains pulled out from the cranium, his eyes replaced by hard plastic. The family dog that lived for 17 years rotating slowly for a week, 2 weeks in a stainless steel freeze-dried drum. Taxidermy is a set of antlers screwed into the skull of a jackrabbit. It's a fish tail sewn to the torso of a monkey. It's a chicken's head stuck right on the body of a stillborn lion cub. Taxidermy is the capture of all these. Taxidermy is their deaths and the deaths of the polar bear, the alligator, the chipmunk, the gorilla, the canary, the moose, the brook trout, the iguana, the joey, the three-toed sloth, the human, the marlin, the dick-dick, the fox, the armadillo, the capercaillie, the ring-tailed lemur. Let's come to terms. Every animal dies. Taxidermy is what comes next.
Steve Madden reading from his book, The Authentic Animal. So you say that you weren't really interested in this idea of just writing a kind of clever examination of the subculture of taxidermists.
Right.
But we do have to kind of talk about what kind of people do this. I mean, because you say it's hunters and it's scavengers and it's scholars and it's scientists. I mean, all kinds of people. But I was wondering, what is the thing that they share, if they do share a kind of interest or characteristic, do you think?
It's something I tried to figure out, right? It was sort of what is the one thing that ties these people together other than the fact that they all do taxidermy, and I wasn't able to find anything because they do come from all walks of life. I mean, it seems that most taxidermists, some are born, right? You know, their fathers or mothers were taxidermists, and so they are as well. Many of them are made. A lot of taxidermists I talked to, a surprising amount really, got into this because they were hunters. And there was a taxidermist nearby who mounted their trophies, and they thought, you know, I can do this just as well. And there's this, you know, the sense that if you're doing it long enough and you've, at first, sure, you can. It's a pretty basic procedure when you get down to it, just to skin the animal. You can get a mannequin through a catalog. You drape it over it. You sew it up, you know, and you're almost done. And it's when sort of the finishing touches of making it look alive, that's where the difficulty comes. But so many, you know, that it, there's, you know, there was the, I write about the Northwestern School of Taxidermy, which for so long, for much of the 20th century, was, you know, they advertised in Field and Stream and tons of magazines of, you know, learn taxidermy and through a correspondence course, and anyone can do it. And it's true on some level. But then, again, when it's sort of the finishing touches and the artistry of it, that's where sort of the wheat and the chaff get separated, I suppose. Hmm.
I guess we should explain what taxidermy is. I mean, everyone figures it's they probably have a hunch of it, but it's kind of it's not just one thing. It's right. an umbrella term, I think, is how you describe it in the book.
It is, yeah. I mean, the typical thing we think of when we think of taxidermy is a deer head on a wall,
yeah.
You know, like a trophy. And that is, you know, not necessarily the origins of taxidermy, but that's a big part of it. The taxidermy industry, that's sort of bread and butter in a lot of ways. But, you know, taxidermy, you know, the word comes from, you know, taxi, it's Latin for arrangement, derma, for skin. You know, so the sense of any arrangement of a skin is, in a sense, taxidermy. So, you know, things like rugs, like sort of bearskin rugs fit in there. And what I was surprised to find out is how much taxidermy happens in museums, not just with the habitat dioramas, which is sort of typical full-body taxidermy as opposed to just heads, but in the, you know, every big natural history museum has a huge amount of collections for research purposes. So, you know, and some specialize in, you know, certain regional collections of native animals, and some try to get everything that's ever existed on the planet. And in there, what'll happen is, so let's say, you know, one of the first collections I saw was at the Nebraska State History Museum, and I saw a drawer of yellow warblers. It's a kind of bird, and there was maybe 30 in there, all lined up and tagged with specific data about how and where they were collected, and every single one had been skinned and stuffed with cotton and sewed back up again. And these are called study skins. So they don't look alive. They're not posed in any way. But, you know, and I asked sort of, why do you need 30 of them? Isn't one enough? And the woman who was in charge of the collection says, well, are you the ideal human specimen? And I just didn't have an answer for her. And I was like, I suppose I'm not. So, you know, there's a certain kind of variation among species that I guess the average person can't see. But when you're studying, say, this specific species, you can see all the variations and get so much information from it. So that was a big eye-opener for me in my research process. Huh.
And taxidermy, even though for a lot of us it seems like kind of something from another time maybe, mm-hmm. you're pretty clear. Taxidermy isn't historic. It's being done, of course.
It's being, yeah. I mean, and now I guess the other form of taxidermy that has arisen in the last few years is what I sort of... Rogue taxidermy, I guess, is the best term for it. And sort of these contemporary artists that get shown in galleries, they originated in Minneapolis, but are now sort of all over the country, if not all over the world. And these are artists who are using animal parts in their art in various, you know, some people that are just using feathers, say, but other artists who have, you know, kind of made themselves working, practicing taxidermists as just as professional as anybody who does this for a living in order to take these parts of animals or sort of reconstruct animals. And I think in the book I kind of call it, it's postmodern taxidermy in the way that it's deliberately drawing attention to its artifice as opposed to what we understand as traditional taxidermy, where the goal is, you know, if you look at that mounted animal and think that it's a real live animal, then that's the number one sort of success for a taxidermist, is that sort of representation and verisimilitude of the authentic animal.
I wanted to ask you about this question of the history of this all,
mm-hmm.
Which gets at the question of why we stuff animals, because you go way back in human history. You write about cave paintings, for example, which tell you what? That the person didn't want to forget the animal or didn't want to forget the experience of killing the animal? I mean, do you think you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of theories about, you know, those cave paintings in Lascaux, France, and sort of why this is what the earliest sort of 2D representations of art and drawing that human beings ever did. Why do they do animals? I mean, you know, there's little people there, but for the most part, what's there is lots of animals that they must have encountered. And one theory that I liked the most was this art historian, Kenneth Clark, who said that these were made at a time when, his phrase is, animals were in ascendance. You know, when we our sort of ability to tame or master or kill or hunt these animals was not as refined as it is now. We had spears at best. They were faster. They were stronger. They were perhaps more vicious. And so he sees these cave paintings as a kind of way of, you know, not recording like, woohoo, this is what we killed today, but rather look at these things that are sort of the mightiest among us, you know, in this kind of way that we make art of the things that sort of awe us, if you will. And that sort of opened up a possibility you know, thinking of taxidermy. It's very different, of course, because the taxidermized animal has been a sort of mastered animal and often a murdered or killed or hunted animal. And yet, you know, there's no reason we have to do this. For whatever your reasons you have for hunting, whether it be for food or just sort of sport, you know, you could leave the skin there.
Yeah.
And yet, for whatever reason, we've taken these parts of the animals and wanted to kind of make a memorial of it. And I think the assumption is, well, that's just a trophy. It's this thing like, look what I killed because I'm so great. And that may be true for many people, but I think there's also a part of it that's like, look at this animal that once lived and how sort of amazing it is.
Yeah.
So to the history, I mean, so moving through, you know, from the cave paintings to when we started actually preserving skins in a way that made them stick around for a long time, it was a similar idea of collection. The sort of early days of the museum involved sort of private, either aristocratic or sort of the wealthy had these sort of, they were called cabinets of curiosities, you know.
Right.
And it's like, look at what I have. It could be anything like art, like a painting of somebody famous or some other aristocrat from somewhere, or little weird curiosities. And many of them were, you know, this was at a time around, Linnaeus had sort of started cataloging animals. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, there's this animal that exists in a foreign country. Look, I've got one. You know, and you can sort of see it. So it's this sense of, again, that dual nature of, okay, I have a certain amount of power. I can take this thing and have it as a kind of trophy, but also this sort of curiosity and wonder of like, look at this thing and how on its own, it's a kind of a wonderful animal.
Dave Madden is with us. He's the author of the book, The Authentic Animal. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Dave Madden is joining us talking about his book about the world of taxidermy. It's called The Authentic Animal. It's about the history of taxidermy, the science, the ethics, the subculture of taxidermists. But what it mostly gets at is what the impulse to stuff an animal says about our relationship with them. Dave Madden is joining us from the studios of WUAL in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He teaches writing, we should say, at the University of Alabama. So I wanted to – a good part of the book is about the man described as the father of modern taxidermy. Mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily invent the form, I guess, but certainly improved it and created a number of innovations. The book isn't really a biography, but I guess – and we're talking about Carl Akeley, but mm-hmm. I guess it helps you sort of move through all the issues. It was kind of the thread that tied it all together in some ways.
Right, yeah. I mean, Carl Akeley's life, you know, one of the first times I asked somebody about taxidermy and, you know, that was a name that was dropped in one of the earliest conversations. And it was after that phrase, the father of modern taxidermy. So I knew from the beginning, okay, well, here's a central figure that I'm going to have to talk about in the book. Eventually it became, like you said, yeah, the through line, a structural element, mm-hmm. because his life really had all the things about taxidermy that I wanted to cover, mm-hmm. pet taxidermy, taxidermy competitions, safaris and collecting, he had a hand in all of that. You know, so I saw, okay, well, I didn't want to write a biography because I wanted to spend a lot of time looking at taxidermy today.
Yeah.
But he became a kind of, I don't know, almost a crutch, if you will, or something mm-hmm. that I could sort of anchor all of my chapters to.
There's this story that you used kind of to begin the book, really. It's just kind of this lovely story that I have to say almost seems impossibly perfect.
Right.
You know, and I mean, it starts with this young woman who lives in Clarendon, New York. It's the mm-hmm. winter of 1876. And as the story goes anyway, she forgot to stoke the fire in her house one night and she managed to kill her pet canary. Talk about that. I want to have you read this section if you would, because I guess it's hard to sort of tell where the story ends and the myth begins, but it is a great story.
It is. I mean, it's a really great story, and it's also very hard to tell where that, like you said, where that myth ends. The bird, the canary itself, has been, you know, had at some point been found by Carl Akeley's second wife after he died in trying to sort of track down his legacy. And we just sort of have to trust through her research that this is the very same bird that now exists in the archives at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. But yeah, the story goes the very first thing he ever mounted was this pet canary that had frozen. And he had gone over to this woman's house. She lived down the road from him. On some errand and saw that she was distressed about this bird and just took a look at it and said, I'll fix it,
yeah.
And sort of grabbed the dead bird and brought it home and then, sure enough, found a way to bring it back to life for her.
Mm. Well, read this section, if you would.
Sure. And this section sort of details the process that he must have gone through. First, he lay the bird on its back and cut a long incision down the breast from neck to tail. He used only a small pocket knife, and he took his time. Once he cut away the bulk of the skin, he dug into the joints, severing the tibia from the hip, the tailbone from the backbone, the wing bones from the shoulder joints, and the vertebrae from the head. What he then held in his hands was the headless, limbless torso of the canary, shapeless and small like some broken toy. Next, he had to remove the eyes and snip out the tongue and scoop the brains from the cranium. Only then was the skin ready for stuffing. He took measurements of the bird before cutting it open and used these numbers to mold from sticky wood shavings called excelsior, a kind of body. Carl took a sturdy length of wire and fit one end of it into this body and another into the canary's skull and made a neck. He stuck four more wires into the excelsior and attached them to each severed limb and made thigh bones and wing bones. Around this posable doll went the skin, which he sewed up along the seam, keeping the stitches small and neat. The eye of a canary is a tiny black orb with a gloss like obsidian. To fill the eye cavities, Carl sneaked a hand in his mother's sewing table and found two glass beads. The final stage of any taxidermy project is the mounting of the specimen. For an animal in a museum, what's needed is a recreated habitat built behind a panel of glass. For something a hunter shot, a wooden plaque and some wall space in the den. A pet has its own demands. It was not enough for Carl to make the canary look lifelike. This was an animal gazed upon every day by its owner. It had to look like itself. It had to look as though nothing tragic had ever happened to it. One Sunday afternoon, a short while later, when the weather was still frigid enough to keep herself bundled in a scarf and muffler, Miss Irene Glidden came home from church to find that the cage in the corner of her room was no longer empty, that right there on its swinging perch stood her canary, which she could even push a little, back and forth, and she smiled when she saw that the bird didn't falter, smiled knowing that maybe it couldn't swing on its own, that maybe it would never sing again, but that she could touch the animal. She could hold it in her hand and it would never fly away.
Do you think, Dave Madden, you understand now, because this sort of gives us a segue into an important part of the book, which is this inclination to want to save our pets.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that is about? Because this practice has been around for thousands of years, trying to mm-hmm. save our pets, stuff our pets. So on one hand, it's about grief, I guess, but what is it, do you think? Do you think you understand it?
I think that I understand, but I don't know that I personally understand. People ask me if I would do this to a dog, let's say if I got a pet, and I say, sure, yes, absolutely. Not having ever actually had a dog, you know, not having spent 10, 15 years of my life with this animal. There are people, of course, and I talked about some in the book, who do. They have these pets, and they cannot let go for whatever reason, and they see pet preservation as a way to keep the pet around. And most people, if they're okay with taxidermy, like hunting trophies on a wall or stuff in museums, are not at all okay with pet taxidermy.
Yeah.
And when you suggest to people after their pet dies, you should get it mounted or freeze-dried, they tend not to like that suggestion, particularly if it's been a day or two, I found out.
Right.
So I think that we see these people who do have kind of a sleeping kitty in the corner of their room, and you realize it's sleeping like that forever, permanently, as kind of deranged. Again, this is what Norman Bates did with his mother, is just sort of keep her around, and that there's a sense that we can't, or this person cannot let go. That may be the case. I don't think it's a kind of derangement. I just think that There's something special about that relationship that they had, and there's a way that they can divorce those feelings from the thing that they kept around. You know, that though it is the very skin of that animal, they recognize that that's not the animal itself, but just a kind of true monument to that life that lived.
You know, I was thinking about when you were reading that part about the canary, and this is one of the elements throughout, that it is, gory isn't the word, but it can be a bit grim, some of these descriptions. One of the first things we read is this, I have to say, really elegant description of how you skin an animal. And you talk about seeing it done. You talk about, for example, the World Taxidermy Championships that you went to a few years ago. This was in a casino in Reno, Nevada. And you write about watching this man, I think his name was Tom Voyer. He's working on this small alligator, and it's not going that well. You describe the process being kind of gory. Did you ever have the sense, I guess talk about that, I mean the art to it and the fact that you have to get over this part of it, which can be, you know, the guts part and the stripping away the flesh part.
Right. I noticed that the two passages that I've just read on the show are very gory.
I know, which we shouldn't say. It's not what the book is all about.
But, that's not much of the book, no. But it's true that they are also up front. And I did want to sort of address all this in the beginning and not sort of shy away from the raw brutality of dismembering an animal. It's not pretty. And, you know, this is one of the things that makes people very, very upset about taxidermy.
Yeah.
And I guess what I saw is, you know, it was a very quick desensitization process, I guess, in that, I guess once you're around it so much, you know, in that scene, as you mentioned with the alligator, you know, it's full of 40, 50 some taxidermists, and we're just placidly watching the sort of systematic dismemberment of an alligator.
One woman is knitting or something, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. She was the wife along for the trip, and she was making a baby blanket. And it's, you know, it's something that, I don't know. You know, I guess if this is what you do, if this is how you make your living and this is how you feed your family, having any kind of queasiness or noting this as something awful or upsetting is not going to get you very far. So for me, I knew in the book I didn't want to just focus on the pretty or creepy, depending on your point of view, end product, but the entire process. And sort of that's another thing that's sort of fascinating to me about taxidermy is how much it requires of the taxidermist to really, you know, get his hands dirty, literally, and then in the process of making this beautiful thing.
You describe taxidermy as a lonely trade. I mean, those gatherings where people come, you say, in some ways they're more about getting together socially, really, than learning more techniques and things.
They are. You know, the loneliness of the taxidermist trade has sort of been abated in recent years with the internet, naturally.
Sure.
But, you know, and there are some taxidermy outfits where you've got two or three people working together. But for the most part, it's a man or a woman in their basement or their garage, you know, just hunting – or, sorry, mounting the hunting trophies of people in the area. So, yes, these conventions, and they happen at the state level. I think every state in the country has a state taxidermist association. It happens at the national level. And at the World Taxidermy Championships, you've got people from all over the world coming in. They are very social, and half of it is a competition and a show of what other people are doing, which is itself instructive. But the other half are these seminars, like this one that I saw, Skinning and Prepping an Alligator was the title. And they have very obscure, you know, or very arcane and specific titles, you know, like, you know, sort of Making Artificial Bark. You know, these things. And it's I think I call it like grad school for taxidermists, how it's so very specialized. And so, yes, it's a kind of instructional thing, but it's also very social. And the taxidermy.net forums are very, very active. And taxidermists love to trade techniques and discuss sort of business practices, because most taxidermists, you kind of have to, that's the hard part. Like it's not enough to just learn how to do it. You also have to be a self-made businessman or businesswoman and figure all that stuff out. So they love to be social and compare prices and all these things.
I wondered, so what's the, if to be good at it, what's the, you know, what's the gift that you have to have? And I go back to Carl Akeley's story where you write about his first job, which comes with this explorer and scientist named Henry Ward. And one of the things that he doesn't get along with Ward very well, at least in the beginning. And part of it is because Carl spends a lot of time looking at the animal and thinking about the animal. And I'm wondering if that's kind of a hint at what made Carl good, is...
Yeah, I would say that it is, absolutely. Right? I mean, there's... Well, at the competitive level, what taxonomists and taxonomy judges talk about is the reference. And any good taxonomist will have binders and binders of photographs that they've taken on their own in the wild, that they found in other either taxonomy trade journals or just wildlife magazines, pages and pages and pages of the faces and eyes of white-tailed deer. And the idea is, you know, if you want to get really good, you need to know a lot of anatomy. And taxonomists as a whole tend to know so much more about parts of animals than anybody I know just casually. So because you have to reconstruct so much of that. The mannequin that you order from a catalog, you know, this piece of foam is only going to give you so much. Mm-hmm. And so when you get to the finishing touches of you need to sculpt the eye and sort of the paint the inside of the nostrils, paint down inside the ears and arrange hair and whiskers in such a way. I talked to one man in Nebraska at the state taxonomy championships there, and he said he spent 90 hours reconstructing the snout of a warthog, sort of hair by hair. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of devotion and I guess it takes a kind of eye. You know, you have to have a kind of artistic eye to be able to see, you know, from the reference to see the animal and then recreate it with your hands. And that's when I started to realize this and talk to taxonomists about this level of artistry is where I really began to be awed by the art form as a whole.
Well, I have to ask you about this part of the book. Having been to my share of diners in Wyoming, we have to talk about the jackalope, this mythical creature that's been kind of an icon of taxidermy, anyway, novelty taxidermy.
Right.
Talk about that, because this is a terrific part of the book.
Well, I knew that was another thing sort of when I went into this book. If I said, okay, I'm going to write a book about taxidermy, I have to write about the jackalope. Yeah. And because, as you said, it's a kind of icon. It's if taxidermy has a sort of mascot, it is that thing. It's
right.
It was an animal invented by a taxidermist, and so the whole we have all kinds of mythic animals in the history of the world. The jackalope's the first one that taxidermy itself invented, and the story goes again how apocryphal this is. I'm not exactly sure.
Who cares? It's great.
Yes, right. The story goes that Douglas Herrick, I believe his name was, in Douglas, Wyoming. Strangely enough. He was a taxidermist and came home one day and didn't have much, from his take. So he tossed a jackrabbit skin, and it landed near some antlers on the floor. And he looked and was like, oh, there's maybe I can mount those together as a kind of funny thing. And he was enterprising enough and close enough to Wall Drug, the huge South Dakota tourist trap, that he just began manufacturing these. And they were just a hit for whatever reason. And so it's got this whole mythology of, you know, the jackalope sort of, you can hear them singing, you know, like in the bluffs, like cowboys, like they'll be harmonizing with cowboys and Douglas, Wyoming particularly is a whole culture of jackalopery. That's quite exciting. But, you know, so I opened my sixth chapter with the jackalope and I see it as the way that taxonomy becomes art. You know, it's not just recreating an animal and being representative of it. But it's sort of taking the stuff of taxidermy and making new things out of it. So you, like the rogue taxidermists we were talking about earlier are in many ways direct descendants of the jackalope. And there's all sorts of other weird, wacky animals that taxidermists have made with sort of, scrap parts. Swamp booger comes to mind. You know, and,
well, you say it's novelty taxidermy is a cartoon fantasy. It's what Walt Disney would have made had he been maybe more outdoorsy, is how you put it.
Yeah, and that we have the Victorians to thank.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, sort of after Darwin, when we kind of let animals in among us or placed ourselves with the animals, there was this need to still like both control them but also kind of picture ourselves as them. So, you know, rabbits and kittens sitting down to tea. I mean, these things were a huge hit in these kind of tableaus back in Victorian England. And then, you know, early parts of the 20th century in the U.S. as well.
You, as you said before, we don't have a lot of time left to talk a lot about this, but you sort of come back around to the contradictions in, and the ethics, I guess, of mm-hmm. taxidermy and hunting. And you write about that on one hand, it kind of, you know, stuffing an animal kind of broadcasts our dominance as a species. On the other hand, it's kind of an homage to nature.
Right.
And I guess, as we said, it's kind of still very much up in the air. I mean, what I like that you said the most almost in the book about all of this is that it's our attempts to lie about the hard truths of life and death.
Yeah. What I realized talking to taxidermists and thinking about this for as long as I did is that, we human beings have great, great capacities for loving animals. And perhaps because of the sort of size of that love or whatever, somewhere in that love exists an ability to harm, if not kill, that animal. And that these things aren't contradictory. And they don't turn us into hypocrites. Or that the way we love animals is different. It's a different kind of love than the way we love human beings. And at first, I thought that that couldn't be true, or that, the taxidermist or the hunter who tells me that he or she loves the animal that he or she kills had to be deluding themselves. But they aren't. And these things can exist together. And it's very confusing to me. I don't hunt, and it's, I don't have this relationship to animals. It's foreign, but it's fascinating. And that's sort of where the book comes out of, is that how do these things work together, this love and this ability to sort of hurt or kill? And how can these things together make something that's so permanent and beautiful as the taxidermized animal?
That's Dave Madden. His book is called The Authentic Animal, Inside the Odd and Obsessive World of Taxidermy. He joined us from the studios of WUAL in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Dave Madden, it's a great book. Really beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.